I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. Hudson Mack joins me now. 30 years ago, in 1985, he moved to Victoria after some time spent in Kamloops and Prince George, and began working on Czech television in Victoria. He's been the face of television news on Vancouver Island, and now he's written a book about it. He also writes about his growing up in Calgary and Salmon Arm and the years at the anchor desk at Czech, then going over to the new VI, its transition to A-Channel to becoming CTV Vancouver Island. He talks about his abrupt resignation last year. It's a storied career we've watched even from this side of the water. The book is called Hudson Mack, Unsinkable Anchor. He joins me now to talk about it, his career in journalism, and more. He has won many awards for his work in television as well as his community service. He lives in Victoria, but where he is also on the faculty at Royal Roads University. You can follow him on Twitter. Hudson H. Mack is the handle. The book is from Harbor Publishing. Please welcome to the Plant on the Line program, Hudson Mack. Mr. Mack, good morning.
Joe, thank you, and I sure appreciate you having me on.
You're very welcome. It really is a pleasure, I must say, when you have people on that you've sort of grown up watching on television. I mean, you must, when you were in Vancouver last week and when you're out and about in Victoria, I'm sure people recognize you on the street, do they?
Well, they have for a long time, and I'm always heartened whenever we're in Vancouver that there's an awful lot of recognition and people doing double takes and probably wondering, where do I know that guy from? And even just, as you mentioned last week, when we were doing some appearances for the book, it's, you know, I've been off the air for, you know, better part of a year and a half now, but it was still happening and people would still come up and say hi and recognize you. So it's good to know, but, you know, you're in people's living rooms for 30-odd years, and I guess it happens.
Yeah, I used to watch you because you would have the Letterman reruns on Czech.
That's right.
And other programs as well, and it's just sort of natural that once those shows ended, you stayed for the news, and I'm surprised at how well I knew the island just from watching Czech.
Well, we've always had a following on the Lower Mainland, and you know, now that everything's on satellite across the country. You know, when we first got up on the bird at Czech, we would get we were thrilled to be getting, you know, feedback and calls, and this was before email, of course, but you know, people watching in Ontario or Newfoundland, transplanted Vancouver Islanders across the country, and I think there's enough people from the island who live in the Lower Mainland that have an interest in the news from the island as well. So we've always had a pretty solid following. It's interesting you mentioned the Letterman reruns. I mean, that was a really good lead-in for us when it was on at 4 o'clock in the afternoon. The only one I think that was stronger was back in the days when we just did a half-hour show at 5:30, and we used to run Archie Bunker All in the Family reruns at 5, and that used to be a particularly solid lead-in. But in this day and age, I'm not sure that a lead-in program has the same impact it once did.
Yeah, I remember that. That's the first time that I watched All in the Family back in the day. It was on Channel 6 here in Vancouver.
And, you know, it's so dated now, but it still stands up in a lot of ways.
Yeah, it holds up, yeah. A lot of the people that you work with on the island, whether you were on Czech or on CTV, ended up coming to this side of the water.
Well, too many to count. You know, I mean, there are so many, and many who worked for me at A-Channel and CTV, and many that I worked with at Czech and or both stations over here. Jason Pires at CTV, and of course Jill Croft has gone on to a great career at BCTV and Global. And I'll leave too many out if I try to name them. But you know, our paths have crossed paths with many people.
So you start the book with the last day at CTV, and so for a lot of people, I mean, the assumption was that you were retired. A lot of people, you know, assumed what they read was right, that you were not retiring, but you were leaving to spend more time with your family. So what exactly happened there?
Well, you know, that's the old euphemism, leaving to spend more time with your family, and you can usually see through that. And I regret that if I in any way misled people into thinking that I had retired, if that's what was inferred from my statement. What happened was, you know, and it's a classic example of what's going on in the industry right now. In February of 2014, I was summoned to a meeting at which I could pretty much predict the outcome. And that was that, you know, we were doing a corporate restructuring, which is, you know, corporate speak for salary dump, and we were going to part company, and I had been there almost 10 years, and I kind of had a feeling that that day may be coming someday. given the way the industry has been going. So I wasn't entirely surprised. And I was given the option, you know, in my conversation with them to frame it publicly that I had resigned, and I said that I didn't want to do that because I had never, you know, I had built a career on people trusting me and telling people the truth, and I didn't want to start, you know, going in a different direction now. So that was on a Thursday, and they wanted to announce it on Monday. So I came to a decision on the Friday to accept the agreement, and we left on good terms. I mean, I have a lot of respect for the people I work for, and still do. And you know, ironically, the general manager of the day has since been that job has since been eliminated. So he too has lost his job at the station, and that's really just a reflection of the way things are going. Certainly at Bell Media specifically right now. But I put a statement out when the word came out Monday morning, and the Times columnist was on the phone, and other media, the wire services, and I guess I should have prepared more thoroughly with a statement, but rather than do a series of interviews, I did write a statement and put it out that the timing was right and that we had agreed to part company, which is all entirely true. As far as the timing goes, it was coincidental that this all occurred just prior to my 54th birthday. And my father was 54 when he died in 1974, when I was 14. Mm-hmm. So the number 54 had always kind of been out there for me as a marker and as a milestone to hit. And it just occurred to me that maybe this was a sign from beyond that the timing was right to make a change, and that now I tend to believe that there are no coincidences. So that was the essence of what I said, that the timing was right, and given the anniversary of reaching that milestone of 54, that the time was right for me to leave and to make a change. I never did say I was retiring, and it's been interpreted as such, and that's fine. I'm not necessarily done with this thing yet.
Yeah, and we'll talk about what you're doing now and what your plans will be in a minute. But you mentioned your father, and a lot of the front of the book talks about what it was like growing up in Calgary, and then you guys moving to Salmon Arm later on. In Calgary, he was a big deal there, wasn't he? He was in municipal politics. He was a broadcaster first and foremost.
Well, he was, and really kind of the North Star for me. And as a child growing up, I was hanging around radio stations, specifically CFAC back in the old days, and the old studios down on 17th Avenue in Calgary. My dad was the morning man in Calgary, and was I'm trying to find a current analogy that I can give you, but it was an era when AM radio and middle of the road radio was a big deal and was it, and everybody had the radio on in the kitchen in the morning as the family was getting ready to go out the door, and he was the guy who got most Calgarians started in the day, and he was enormously popular and very committed to the community and to helping organizations, and was political, as you mentioned. He was a seven-term alderman in the 50s and 60s and ran for mayor twice, and was involved in a lot of charitable organizations and on a lot of boards, and did a lot. When he left CFAC in 68, in circumstances not unlike mine, he did some other things. He loved to fly, and he was the manager of the Flying Club, but he missed radio, and he got back into radio. And then we decided to leave Calgary and move to Salmon Arm in 1971. And like most people from Calgary who go to the Okanagan, you turn south at Sicamoose, and you don't go all the way to Salmon Arm. He fell in love with the place, and we did too, and we moved there when I was 11. And I stayed there till the end of high school, and then went back to journalism school at State in Calgary in 1978.
Now, your brother Gary, he'd left home already, right? He was old. He was a little older.
Yeah,
than
he was. He is also also has died. In fact, my whole immediate family. I'm the last survivor of my immediate family. My brother was 12 years older than me. His name, as you say, was Gary Mack, and my dad had got him started in radio as well. He hired him when he was the program director at CFAC to do the all-night show when he was in high school on the weekends. And from there, my brother moved around a little bit, as most of us do at the beginning. He was in Winnipeg and then in Yorkton. And when he was at CJGX in Yorkton, he and another guy by the name of Dan McAllister, who, small world that this is, crossed paths with me in Kamloops years later, and then I've known him for years here. He was the general manager of the Q and just retired, one of the top radio executives on the island. So he and Dan put an ad in the Broadcaster magazine, and my brother got a bite from Dick Smythe, the legendary Toronto newsman, who at that time was the news director at CKLW in Windsor. Windsor is, as many people listening will know, just across the river from Detroit.
Yeah.
And CKLW was just approaching its zenith as the monster radio influence in top 40 radio and in broadcasting in the day. I cannot overstate what a big deal CKLW was. And at the time it was owned by RKO General in the U.S. until the Trudeau government forbade foreign ownership of broadcasting companies in Canada. And then it was bought by Baton. And it eventually met its demise in the 80s, largely because of the Canadian content music rules. But he went there in 67, which was the summer of the riot in mm-hmm. Detroit. And it was really baptism by fire for this 19-year-old kid who was still wet behind the ears in terms of his news career. Learned a lot from Smythe. Smythe left a couple of years later to go back to Toronto to go back to Chum, and he was made news director at age 21. And this was around the time when CKLW was really in its ascendancy. He developed what was known as 2020 News, which was news at 20 after and 20 to the hour to offset the newscasts on other stations when people were punching the buttons in their car at the top and bottom of the hour.
Mm-hmm.
And they developed, you could call it rock and roll news that fit the format of the station. It was lurid, it was tabloid, it was blood and guts, it was sensational. And they, you know, if you go to any journalism school in the country, there are old air checks and tapes of these newscasts, and people can't believe that they're not put-ons. You know, talking about guys getting strained through the grill of a Buick and 16 toes peeking out from under the rubber blankets at the Wayne County morgue. And those are, you know, actual quotes from newscasts. And it was enormously successful, and he had a terrific career that was eclipsed only by his work on a spoken word record called The Americans.
The Gordon Sinclair piece, right?
That's right. It started out, this was 1973, and it was, you know, Watergate was on, and the Vietnam War was dragging on, and Americans were feeling underappreciated in the world, and Sinclair, who was at CFRB in Toronto at the time, he was for his career, wrote in one of his editorials a piece about how the American Red Cross was on the verge of going bankrupt that year because of a series of tornadoes and disasters and floods, and how that the Americans rush to the aid of people around the world, but nobody else seems to come to the aid of the Americans. So at CKLW, my brother picked this thing up. It had moved on the wire service, and they read it as part of a Sunday morning background program. And they were inundated with requests for copies, and a guy named Armin Baladian at Westbound Records in Detroit said, hey, we should record this. So they got the Detroit Symphony Orchestra playing America the Beautiful, and my brother and his big, booming, great reed and beautiful voice delivered this stirring rendition of it. It sold about 1 million copies in the first 3 or 4 days, went on to sell about 5 million. But in the agreement that they had made with Gordon Sinclair for the copyright permission, he had agreed to give, my brother that is, had agreed to give all of his net proceeds to the American Red Cross, which was about $100,000 in 1973 dollars, which was a big deal.
So, yeah.
So that was very cool, and he had a really, if he had been had a meteoric rise in success locally in Detroit, it was now transferring nationally. He was on the Today Show and on Don Kirshner's rock concert and all the shows of the day performing this piece, and it was very cool. It was really neat.
So you've talked about your dad, you've talked about your brother. What was it inevitable for you to get into broadcasting?
Well, I think it was, you know, because I was just a kid in Calgary, and you know, my dad wasn't in news, but was a consummate professional, and unfortunately, I have precious few recordings of him. But he was the kind of broadcaster that you don't really come across. I mean, sort of the old school pro that you think of from the golden age. So, I'd always thought I wanted to get into radio, or hadn't really thought of television at that point. And then when my brother was so successful in news, and I would go down and visit him and sit there and watch these guys do their thing at the Big 8 at CKLW, I was like, well, I want to get into news. So that really was the driving force for me in terms of, career influence. And so I went back to Calgary after graduating in Salmon Arm, went to SATE for 2 years on the basis of my family. My mom and sister still living in Salmon Arm, arranged a practicum and an internship at CFJC in Kamloops in the spring of 1980, and the 3 weeks came and went, and it had gone well, and they put me right on the air, which is one of the reasons why, you know, for students starting out in this business, going to a smaller market really is advantageous, although the entry-level jobs don't exist in the way they did 35 years ago. But Kamloops was a success, no job. I went back to Salmon Arm, worked at the liquor store for the summer, which was a terrific job. A good friend of mine at Salmon Arm, who had the same summer job, stayed there and spent his whole career working there and loves it and has raised his family in Salmon Arm and has had a great life. But so at the end of the summer, I was beginning to worry that I didn't have a broadcasting job. And Doug Collins at CFJC picked up the phone and said, "Do you want to come back and read the late news?" And I jumped at it without even discussing terms or salary or anything. And it was a terrific start for me.
And so right into TV, right?
Well, it was a combined radio TV shop. So I was anchoring the late news on the television and desking and reading hourly newscasts on the AM and FM stations in the evening. So for a kid straight out of school, it was a terrific experience. And you know, some of the stories of the time were great learning experiences for me as well.
Yeah, and so you also went to Prince George, and then it was in the I guess the early 80s that you ended up on the island in Victoria.
Well, I went to Prince George in 82, which was sort of a weird kind of a lateral move. I mean, you start out and you think, well, I'll do 2 years here, 2 years there, and move to a bigger market each time. And it was kind of a lateral move going from Kamloops to Prince George. But in retrospect, it was a good move because I gained a lot of experience there and kind of got some maturity as well. And in 85, I had a chance to go to Edmonton to work for the CBC and turned it down. And as I write in the book, it was largely because of the Calgary versus Edmonton animus that still exists, which seems like a dumb reason to turn down a network job. And as soon as I hung up the phone for the final time with the guy, I thought, oh, gee, I've really blown it here. And as luck would have it, fortuitously, Czech TV called a few weeks later and asked if I wanted to come down here and do the late news here. So I came to Victoria in April, started April Fool's Day, 1985, at Czech, and again with an intent to be a couple of years here, a couple of years there, and never left. I fell in love, not just with Vancouver Island, but with my wife, who was a producer-director at the station as well.
Yeah, and so for a lot of your time at Czech, it was the only game in town, so, I mean, everybody was watching it on the island, weren't they?
Well, it was. You know, Czech had just moved into the building that they're in now, which had been built by the CBC in 83-84, and then as soon as it was completed, the CBC decided it didn't want to have a standalone station in Victoria and would continue to operate from its bureau at the legislature. And we were competing, you know, at Czech. The interesting thing about the Vancouver Island market and for island stations, which are, you know, relatively small in terms of their budget and staff size, is that we're competing and expected to compete at a high level in the Greater Vancouver television market, which is the second most lucrative English language market, you know, in the country. And in addition to that, there is such penetration by the Seattle stations in cable. Mm. So you're competing against at a level with the number 10 or 11 market, whatever Seattle is now in the U.S. So people have pretty high expectation, even though you're running a pretty small operation. But yeah, Czech had an enormous following, and our aside from the bureaus feeding into the Vancouver newscasts, our competitor really was the Times Colonist newspaper.
Yeah, and I mean, you write about that in the book, about competing for stories and then ending up working with one another at one point, right?
The whole thing with the Times Colonist, when Canwest Global went on its buying spree and had purchased Czech and BCTV from WIC, Western International Communications, from the Griffiths family, mm-hmm. It also was on its acquisition binge and was buying up print properties across the country. And that was the early days of so-called convergence, which may or may not have succeeded to the extent that people thought it would. But we were now partners with the TC, and our fierce competitor was now our partner, and we were sharing story lists and contacts, and it felt very odd at first.
Yeah, leaving Czech is something that you discuss in the book. I remember when that happened; it was big news even here throughout the province. What happened there? I mean, were you really disappointed that you'd been passed over for the news director job?
Well, I hope that the in the when people read the book, they won't think that I'm whining about that or feeling sorry for myself. But really, in the end, I had been at Czech for 19 years, and on four occasions had been passed over to become the news director. And I had been part of I'd been the assistant news director there for many years since early on. And I had been involved with the News Directors Association, the professional group across the country, which was then known as the RTNDA, and has since juggled its acronym to RTDNA to reflect digital news.
Mm-hmm.
So I was associating with people across the country who were leading news departments. I felt that I was ready in terms of my ability and my maturity and experience to lead the Czech news department. The problem was the senior management, and that was in Vancouver at the time, did not want to have the anchor as news director because they had had a less than successful experience with that. And they weren't willing to take me off the air because I was popular on the air. I wasn't necessarily ready to go off the air, but if I had given the opportunity to run the department, I probably would have.
Mm-hmm.
So it just became apparent to me after a while, and after close to 20 years, that maybe I was where I was going to get at Czech, and I really didn't want to leave the island. I had passed up a number of opportunities to move over the years. Ironically, many of those offers came from Edmonton. And I just thought when the opportunity arose, I didn't really take it seriously at first, but as we got deeper into the process, it occurred to me that I was ready to do something and that maybe Czech didn't think that I was going to leave, that I would actually pull the trigger on it. And when the Chum people approached me when they were trying to revitalize and restart the new VI, I just thought it was an opportunity that was irresistible.
I mean, you didn't even think that you would leave yourself, right?
No, I didn't, And Richard Gray, who is the guy who enticed me to leave, who's a good friend in the industry and one of the tops in the business, I think, he had come to town, and I knew he was coming to fix the new VI. When Chum got the second license for television in Victoria, we were quite concerned at Czech that, we were no longer the only game in town, and we didn't have the sandbox all to ourselves. And Chum had a reputation for doing things well, and they had lots of money to spend, and, this was, again, the early 2000s when the economy was robust and broadcasting in this country was in a healthier state. So we were a little concerned, and then as they went through the process of building the station and they missed their startup for September 1st of 2001, they launched on October 4th of 2001, which was just weeks after 9/11,
mm-hmm.
and everybody was still so traumatized by that. I'm not sure that that overshadowed their launch. But we could see, from the outset that this thing wasn't really going to be much of a threat to us, and we're a metered market, which means we get the overnight ratings by about 10 o'clock the next day, and we could see that we were trouncing them night after night after night. And this went on for a couple of years through 2003, early 2004, before Chum realized that, they just couldn't carry on without doing something. So they sent Richard to Victoria to fix it, and he presided over a couple of rounds of staff cuts because the place was wildly overstaffed for its size and for the revenue it was generating. And they did some market research to figure out what they could do to gain some credibility in their news department. And I say this with no hubris intended, but the feedback was almost universal on these focus groups was to hire me, to get me to leave Czech and come and lead the new VI. So that happened, and when they made the approach, I was quite transparent with my masters at Czech and told them that I was meeting with them, but that it was really more than anything an intelligence gathering exercise, and I would report back what I found.
Mm.
And then as we got farther along, as I said earlier, it became apparent to me that this was something I really couldn't say no to.
So there was no bitterness on your part towards the people at Czech when
no,
you
not
left?
At all.
Yeah.
No, not a bit.
Do you think there's bitterness from them, perhaps?
Well, I think there is now, among some anyway. I mean, I still have friends who are there, and the staff has turned over. And, it's I've been told by other people in the industry that for its size, in that period when I left in 2004 until when I left CTV in 2014, that for the market size, it's probably the most intensely competitive market in the country, at least it was. I mean, it was a, we used to joke that it was, you know, we wanted to beat each other up every night at five, but we didn't want to kill each other because competition is a healthy thing. And when we went through the whole Save Local TV exercise in, in the you know, early 2010s, we didn't want either one of us to disappear because competition is good for your bottom line, and it's certainly good to motivate people. And I knew that from being a Czech with no direct competition across the street for so many years. But a lot of, you know, there was a lot of chirping, and you know, I will acknowledge that I, you know, said things in the heat of competition that probably got back to them, and vice versa. There was some less than gentlemanly activity going on. There was, you know, some, I don't want to say fudging of the numbers, but there was, you know, I'm not sure that clients were being given the exact picture in terms of what the ratings race was. And, you know, so I think there was some bitterness there.
Well, what are the ratings in terms of those two stations in Victoria on the island there?
Well, I'm not privy to what they are now. You know, we had a meteoric rise when I got there in 04, although, you know, in all honesty, the new VI had nowhere to go but up. But we were suddenly a player, and we were neck and neck. They would trot out their 2+ number, which is like their every, you know, everybody in the world watching, when advertisers really want the 25-54 demographic. And in terms of the 25-54s, we were competitive with them, beating them. I wouldn't say we consistently beat them, but we did some nights, and, you know, it was back and forth, but it was certainly a competitive market. We never really did, and this is probably true of a lot of cases where somebody crosses the street, as it's known. You don't, you know, we didn't knock them out, which had been my hope, but I was always satisfied with what we had done and what we had, and I, you know, the number two guy will always tell you that the system is flawed, but I always thought that we had more people watching than those numbers might have indicated, because anecdotally we just couldn't have had an audience that wasn't what it seemed to be, given what we were on the street, the feedback we would get from people.
Do you miss anchoring the news?
I do, you know. I mean, some days I've gotten quite into a pattern, excuse me, in the last, you know, 16 to 18 months. And the book has been a great project, and I'm doing some teaching as well, as you mentioned at the outset. But, yeah, I do miss it. And I still have people come up to me, and I'm heartened by this, and say, God, we miss you on the air. We sure would like to see you back on the air. And like I say, I'm sitting out right now, and we'll see what the new year brings after I do another trim at Royal Roads. But I do miss it, and I think it's the kind of job where, you know, I'm 55 now, and it's not the sort of thing that age is really a hindrance to you. It perhaps is to your advantage to have a little gravitas and a little experience.
You talk in the book, too, about the future of broadcasting and the teaching that you do now at Royal Roads. When you talk to students that go through your classes, the reality of the business today, I mean, when they look at you and see the career that you've had, is that a possibility for a lot of your students?
Well, that's a $64,000 question, isn't it? The short answer is no. I don't think the era of for me and guys like me who got into it 30, 40, 50 years ago of having a single career in terms of doing largely the same thing for most of your working life and doing it for one or two or three companies. I think that era is probably over. You know, the future will be in people acting as free agents and doing piecemeal work and doing freelance work, part-time work for two or three different employers. You know, the whole notion of appointment television for news has gone out the window. That said, though, I still believe that, you know, I mean, here's a great example of it right now, Joe. We're talking on your podcast. You're presenting this, and this is what would be considered 10 years ago a non-traditional form of media. Now it's become largely mainstream. And why do people listen? Well, it's because they know that they can trust you, and you've established yourself as having credibility
in the research you do, the questions you ask, the guests that you invite to come on with you. You know, they people will get their news on Twitter, on their phone, from whatever source it may be, but there'll always be a need for someone who has credibility, who is someone you can trust, somebody that as a viewer or a listener or a reader, you can say, I believe what this guy is saying or doing, because he or she has done their homework and has done the checks and balances. So, you know, whether it's on a handheld device, and that really is the future of the thing, I think, there still is a need, and there'll always be a need for local news, too.
Mm. Yeah, I think that's something that when one reads your book, just the value of that comes through. I mean, whether you were at Victoria or in any of the markets that you worked at, people want the news. I mean, people will watch Walter Cronkite, they'll watch your friend Dan Rather, you know, will watch Mansbridge, but we always go back to home, don't we?
Well, yeah. You'll always want to know what's going on in your community, and that's yeah. And when I talk to students, and I say this with my group at the Royal Roads, that, you know, many of them, you know, the interesting thing about that is that some of them have been to journalism school, some of them have, you know, broadcast experience, but have come back to get a degree, and it's the Bachelor of Professional Communications program. And they recognize that the future is in different modes of communication, and maybe it's doing corporate communication, maybe it's government communication, maybe it's to hone their own skills to become a communication source in and of themselves, and that's where I think the future is. But yeah, the whole thing, we were still shooting, well, they just finished shooting film in Kamloops when I got there, and, you know, when I went to SAIT in the late 70s, we learned to physically splice audio tape, because that was still a skill that was in demand. And now, you know, anybody getting into the business now needs to be a multitasker. They need to be a good reporter, a good writer, and I can't stress enough the importance of good writing and command of the language. You need to be a technician because you need to know how to shoot, you need to know how to edit, you need to know how to FTP that story back to the station in time for the next available newscast, you need to be able to set yourself up to do a live hit with the network, you also need to be tweeting continuously to update your story if it's breaking news, you need to have a mastery of social media, and you know, all of this turning out two or three stories a day in many cases. So the era of doing one thing or being able to do one thing is long gone.
The other thing that comes through in the book, and it's just lovely to read, is the family that you had around you, whether it was your parents and your siblings, and now your wife Patty and your three kids. I mean, it wasn't without heartache and pain through your life, but what emerges is how close you all are.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. If that comes through, then I think I've succeeded, because I'm most proud of my family. You know, Patty and I have three wonderful kids, and we've chosen to stay on Vancouver Island, and our daughter is just home from she got her Bachelor of Commerce a year ago and then went straight into an accelerated Masters of Global Business program at the Gustafson School of Business at UVic, and she was in France and South Korea, and now she's back home, and she's you know, just setting out on what promises to be an exciting career for her. Our oldest son, Hamilton, is taking a Bachelor of Sports Management program, switching out of a few years of poli-sci at UVic, realizing, and I encourage our kids to listen to their gut and don't be afraid to make a change, and don't do something that you think you were intended to do or that your parents want you to do. For young people listening who don't know what they want to do in their career, it's okay not to know, because, you know, I used to think it was guidance counselor mumbo-jumbo in the 70s when they would say, oh, don't worry, the job you're going to do hasn't been invented yet, and we would roll our eyes. Well, you know, website developer, you know, blogger, you know, any of these things that we didn't even know were out there. Who knows what the next 2 or 3 or 5 years will bring? So, but for Ham, getting into sports management is right up his alley. He has an encyclopedic knowledge of all sports and is interested in it, and this program at Camosun has a terrific record of placing managers in various capacities in various sports organizations and teams and leagues, so he's really excited about that. And our youngest son, Sheldon, was at UBC last year on a football scholarship and decided to take a year off from university with a coaching change and some changes going on at the university. came back here. He was playing junior football and suffered an injury, which ended the season this year. But he's already had some sniffs from some other CIS programs in the Canadian university system. So he'll be going back and doing that. And he loves football. And but you know, even with his season ending, and I said to him, don't feel like you have to do this because you know because you think that this is what we expect you to do. If anything has come clear to me in the aftermath of leaving CTV, it's that we get so caught up in identifying ourselves by what we do. Mm. Who we are is not what we do. And don't feel that, you know, because this is what you identify with yourself or what others identify with you, don't do it. We went to see Deepak Chopra speaking in Victoria the other night. And I tend to be, you know, a bit of a cynic after all the years in the newsroom that I've spent. But I thoroughly enjoyed it. And what I took away from that was that, you know, whatever your spirituality may be or may not be, you have a sense of your own being and who you are, your sense of self. And that's what carries you through your whole life. All of the experience that you have is in time, but your being is not in time. This is stuff that's just kind of passing through you, and we don't know what's coming over the horizon, but we can see what happened yesterday. But just don't lose sight of the fact of who you are in this journey. I mean, this is getting kind of mystic, I know, but you know, it was quite profound for me, and I think that kind of comes through in the book too. I think I'm probably more of a spiritual than religious person, but you know, when my dad died, and then you know, my sister and my brother, and we also read in the book about I also tell about our niece dying unexpectedly the same year as my brother. You know, these knocks that come at you. If anything comes out of it, I hope for people, and then it's implied in the title, Unsinkable. It's that we all have a resiliency in us, and you just have to keep on keeping on.
And you couldn't go to church because you'd faint all the time, I read in the book.
Well, as a child, yeah, we used to go to St. Mark's Church in Calgary, my sister and I, and we were in the choir loft, and it was like a chimney. You'd be standing there, and you had to stand for the whole service, and Reverend Niblock was his name. Lovely man, but he went on and on and on, and my parents would luck up and see me keeling over, and they'd be carrying me out out cold, so they said we could stop singing in the choir if we wanted.
Now, you mentioned your kids. Did they ever show any interest in broadcasting?
They did, you know, and you know, Rachel had an interest in it in terms not necessarily of the journalism side, but when she was pursuing, you know, some of the opportunities, and it may still happen for her in broadcasting and marketing and communication. Hamilton was probably the one who showed the greatest interest in an on-air career, and I encouraged them to a point, and he may still, you know, take a stab at it. I don't know. He was interested in the BCIT program a few years ago, but I've never wanted to push them into it, but I certainly wouldn't discourage them from it, although, you know, the realization is that it's not particularly lucrative in the early going, and they need to understand that, and I think a lot of young people today are turned off by that. At least the people who want to get into the business for the right reason, and by that I mean don't want to get into TV to be on TV. And unfortunately, I think we've gone through a period where a lot of people entering the business did so without what I would consider to be the right motivation.
When I started the book, I wanted to know just the name Hudson Mack, because it sounds like one of those made-up TV names.
Yeah, it absolutely does, and if so, it also sounds like it's backwards. I've had Mac Hudson my whole life, and if I ever check into a hotel and they don't have a record of me, I say, "Well, look under, try Mac Hudson." Oh yeah, there you are. it does. It's and I write a little bit about in my brother's experience. I mean, he was known in the industry as Byron McGregor.
Mm-hmm.
So when he went to CKLW in '67, he was told he had to change his name, and Byron McGregor is actually my uncle's name, my mother's brother. And just to carry it a little bit further, not to get too deep into the weeds, Byron McGregor isn't really his name. His name was Alexander Bell McGregor, Alec McGregor, but he switched to Caballerianism, which is, you know, you add up the value of the letters in your name and you get your number. And he didn't like how that added up, so he switched to Byron. When my brother went to Windsor in '67, Dick Smythe says, "You got to change your name." And my brother was like, "Well, what do I change it to?" And he says, well, how about, do you have an uncle or something? That's a really bad Smythe impression, by the way. And he says, well, I'm staying with my uncle, Byron McGregor. And Smythe was, oh, Byron McGregor, that's good. You'll be Byron McGregor. So my uncle wasn't that keen on it. He said, yeah, go ahead. But later, when my brother enjoyed a lot of fame and goodwill in the community, he liked it. My name came from a suggestion from the obstetrician who delivered me, who was a family friend from the clinic in Calgary where my mom worked. My parents had been on a motor trip in the late 50s in a 1958 Hudson Jet. Or a Wasp, one of the Hudson model, one of the Hudson cars, and it broke down. The axle split just outside Hamilton. So my middle name is Hamilton. So the Harry Oberon, the obstetrician, says, "Well, he was conceived in Hamilton because of the Hudson. Call him Hudson Hamilton." So from that, we named our oldest son Hamilton as well. Now, family folklore over the years and Jim Gibson, who used to write a column in the Victoria Times, Times Colonist,
right,
a gossip column, got a hold of that one time and wrote it up. But he embellished it that the conception had occurred in the Hudson, which was not the case. And my mother was absolutely aghast. She was really so, I don't want to say angry, but just, shook her head that I had allowed this to get in the paper. So it wasn't in the Hudson, but the Hudson broke down in Hamilton, and that's where it started.
And Thanksgiving was last week. Gravy, you were in charge of that, were you?
Well, we this year, and it's interesting you ask, this year we were guests at Patty's brother and his wife's with their family, so we had our Thanksgiving dinner there. I did cook a small turkey just to have some leftovers for sandwiches because my niece Liz from Calgary had come out, and something that became a bit of a tradition for us was when my mom would be out here for Thanksgiving would be to go to French Beach, which anyone on the island may know is just gorgeous, and we would go on the Monday after Thanksgiving dinner and eat big turkey sandwiches on the beach. So my kids are such traditionalists about everything. They wanted that. So when we were going out for dinner, I said, well, don't worry, I'll cook a turkey breast and we'll have some sandwiches, which we did. But I didn't make gravy because we didn't have a full meal. But I do make pretty good gravy, I'm told.
Yeah, well, you'll have to give us a secret one day, won't you?
It's all in the roux.
It's such a delight to talk to you. I've enjoyed this book a great deal. I hope it continues to do well for you. Thanks for this, Hudson.
Well, thank you, Joe. And I'm sorry if I've rambled on. My kids, we had a book launch signing event the other night at Boland Books in Victoria, which was really well attended. I was really thrilled.
Uh-huh.
And I was had a half a dozen passages that I had picked to read and was weaving it together with stories and anecdotes. And I could see my kids in the front row kind of giving me the wrap-up sign at certain points because I tend to go off on these tangents. But you've been very indulgent, and I really appreciate your time and inviting me on today.
You're very welcome. The book is called Hudson Mac, Unsinkable Anchor. It's from Harbor Publishing. It's author Hudson Mac. Join me on the line from Victoria in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Planta.